Thank you, America. For over 70 years, GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance, and because of you, they've been the nation's fastest-growing car insurance company over the past 5 years. To show our appreciation, call within the next 15 minutes and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. This is not a limited-time offer, and okay, actually you could call whenever you like. But why are we even arguing about this, America?
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Batabi Leventombini, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. The financial meltdown of 2008 has bred a new class of entrepreneurs, those who have become small business owners out of necessity. Any entrepreneur should know that the true way to make real money as an entrepreneur is to grow your company and sell it for profit. Today, my guest is private equity expert and successful entrepreneur, Pankaj Amin. He is the managing director of SC Ventures, a consulting firm and investment fund, and he will share with us the secrets of what kinds of companies make good investments and explain how private equity investors decide what to buy. You are listening to an amazingly talented musician from South Africa named Bongeziwe Mabandla. The song is called Gnuza. Listen and enjoy as everyone gathers. I'll be back with you in just a moment.
Well, hello,
everyone, and thank you for joining us. As I mentioned in the introduction, my guest today is Pankaj Amin, the Managing Director of SC Ventures, an investment firm that invests in small businesses. Today, we will be talking about how entrepreneurs can strategize their business developments with an eye towards selling that business to investors for a profit at some point in the future. Pankaj, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Good. And again, I'm so pleased to actually have Pankaj here with me in person. He's not on the phone, but he's actually sitting right here in my fabulous studio, seeing all the wonderful technology that we use to broadcast the show. So I'm really glad that he is right here with us. Before we start, let me tell you in the audience how you can participate in the show. The chat room is open. So if you're listening online, please feel free to join in. You can ask questions there. I'll be checking in from time to time, and you can chat with each other. So we've had that happen as well. If you hear something on the show that interests you, you can make a comment, and whoever's there in the chat room with you can also chat along with you. So as I said, I'll be checking in there from time to time. We can ask questions or make comments. And you can also call in to ask questions or make comments. The number to call is 818-532-9789. That's 818-532-9789. Okay, so let's dive right in. As I mentioned, the financial meltdown of 2008 has brought about a new level of entrepreneurship in the country, and I'm sure that many people in the audience are either thinking about starting businesses or are in business already or know a small business owner. I also know that a lot of truly successful business tycoons like Martha Stewart and Steve Jobs started out with very small ventures in their own homes. And I'm an advocate of dreaming big, but even dreams need some direction. So I'm going to ask you to help us out here, Pankaj, and talk about the secrets of growing a company that is attractive to investors, which is how most entrepreneurs really end up making their money, right?
Sure. That's actually very true. If you look at people who have made substantial amounts of money, more often than not, you'll find that the people who made a lot of money did not make it as an employee of another company. They usually make it in owning some piece of an enterprise, whether they're a partner at the law firm, they're a partner at the bank, or they go off and they start their own business. And in many ways, it's important to recognize that because owning your own business is much more accessible to us here in the United States. And that's one of the advantages of the United States. And that access is something that we should take to heart as an advantage of, given that we did have the meltdown of 2008, there are opportunities for potential entrepreneurs to be budding out of that meltdown that we just had.
Right. And speaking about being able to benefit from the openness to business culture that we have here in the United States, you know a little bit of something about being an entrepreneur and business ownership. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you've come to know so much about this topic.
Sure. So I learned about the concept of buying and then personally operating a business back when I was in business school. And it was something that really enticed me because many people come out of a business school or other type of education, and then they go and work for another company. My personal background is I come from parents who were entrepreneurs themselves, and I really wanted to take the rigor of a business education and a technical education, which is what I have, and put that to bear in a small business, which can be, as you know, sometimes chaotic. And so that's what I did. In 2001, I founded SC Ventures, which is focused on looking at investing in and personally operating middle-sized small businesses in America. I looked at several hundred companies and ultimately bought a telecommunications company in California. It was a company that installed, maintained, and repaired business phone systems for major business customers all over California. And I ran that business for 7 years. Throughout the 7 years, I learned the good, the bad, and the ugly about running a business. And I'm happy to talk about all of those things because knowing how to manage through the bad and the ugly is what's going to get you to that potential payout at the end. And then I sold that particular business in February of 2011, so a couple of months ago.
Right. So then you are perfectly situated to be able to talk with folks about, you know, both the theory and, you know, the knowledge that comes with having a business school education. But for you, it's not just theoretical. You actually have hands-on experience with this very topic that we're talking about.
Absolutely. And what I would say is, I mean, Thomas Edison once said that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. And I would say similarly that success in business, although it may not be genius, success in business is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. So you can take a lot of theories from a business school and learn about them in a book, but when you really put them to use in actual situations in an operating role where you're dealing with customers, you're dealing with employees, you're dealing with vendors and suppliers, I've often said that owning a business is like a PhD in psychology because you really learn how to manage through the group dynamic and psychological element of working with other people.
Right. And that's really what it is about when you're an entrepreneur. Having people skills and all of that, it's very,
absolutely,
very important. So there are a lot of things that are involved in knowing not only how to run a business, but how to choose what to invest in.
Sure.
And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. How do you know what to invest in? And this is a perfect segue, actually, because in figuring out how to organize this show so that it is relevant to folks who are listening, I thought, you know, let me take what is a sort of common scenario, unfortunately common scenario, in this particular economic climate. A lot of people who traditionally would not have been let go have been let go, and this includes people who have professional backgrounds, who would otherwise be qualified to manage, have been in managerial roles before. And so this is a person who might be let go and is given a severance package, let's say.
Okay.
So now you've got a few thousand dollars in the bank and you're trying to decide what to do. And a lot of people, of course, spend quite a bit of time searching for work.
Yep.
And we've heard some truly sobering stories about people who have spent 1, 2, 3 years looking for work and not being able to find a job. So when the climate is like that, it seems that, and a lot of people are finding that entrepreneurship is a way that
in some ways a necessity,
right,
for some people. And I would say, just to touch on that one topic a little bit, the job market is not good.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what you're hearing in the media or what you're hearing from Washington, at the end of the day, if you're out there looking for a job and it's been 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and you're not finding that position, the reality is that your experience is giving you information about the market. One thing that I would say is very important, both as a job seeker and as a potential entrepreneur, because necessity, as you're saying, is pushing many people towards entrepreneurship, is don't let the overall context drag you down emotionally or mentally, because if you're not finding a job, that doesn't mean that you don't have value in the marketplace. It just means you have to restructure how you're offering your value to the marketplace.
Right.
And entrepreneurship is potentially a way of doing that.
Right.
I've often said that we're going to become a nation of independent contractors.
Right.
Whether that's good or bad is something that we can debate.
But I actually want to talk a little bit more about that. You know, on Friday, I think it was, I came across an article in the New York Times that was talking about how corporations are now tending to invest more in equipment and less in personnel. And we talked a little bit about what that might mean and what it might mean for us to now be a nation of independent contractors. So tell me a little bit more about what that means.
What that means is, and I think the article that you read is probably hitting on that same topic, it's that when businesses are looking at hiring or investing, they're going to make a strategic decision towards what's going to be best for them from a cash flow perspective and a liability perspective, et cetera. So, for example, if I were a company and I had the opportunity to hire another 50 people or invest in capital equipment, well, the tax situation allows you to write off and sometimes pull forward your depreciation expenses towards that capital equipment.
But what does that mean in, like, regular people?
What that means is you can actually get a tax write-off today, depending on the amount of that equipment purchased. You can potentially pull forward the entire tax write-off into year one. Versus hiring 50 people, for example, you may not, in many ways, when you hire 50 people or X number of people, you're taking on extra liabilities associated with having people on your payroll.
Well, you've got your payroll taxes.
Payroll taxes, health care potentially in the future, other types of taxes.
Unemployment.
Unemployment taxes, SUI, SDI, vacation, accrued vacation, which is top priority in terms of liabilities. So at the end of the day, people or businesses look at those two options and they say, well, I'm going to invest in the equipment. Now, that doesn't work bode very well for the person who's looking for a job, unfortunately. And that gets back to potentially entrepreneurship as being the avenue out of that particular situation.
So how about that work in a hypothetical scenario? You have a corporation that might have hired someone to do some work, and instead they're going to farm out that business or that work to somebody else who actually owns their own business? I mean,
yeah.
How does this work?
So, yes, that's a perfect example. So what we're seeing is that outsourcing, quote-unquote outsourcing, does not necessarily mean sending that job over to some foreign country. What it can potentially mean is instead of having someone on my payroll to do this function, I'm going to have an independent contractor or an outside firm do that work for us. They might pay a slightly higher hourly rate for that, but at the end of the day, it might be cheaper for them or it might be easier for them as a business. So let me give you an example. I've talked to colleagues of mine who are in the actuarial business, and they have said that sometimes because of the seasonality of actuaries, it actually helps some of the large insurance companies. It's helpful for them to hire an actuary on a contract basis, because there are 4 to 5 months of the year where they're very, very busy, and then there's 3-4 months of the year where they're not very busy.
Now, just for the sake of people who might not know, what is an actuary?
Well, an actuary is one type of profession that is involved in assessing insurance risk for insurance companies.
And so if an insurance company hires an actuary and has them on staff, that person is only really busy for part of the year.
Potentially, yeah.
Right?
That's
or
potentially.
And
so in that situation, they might be better off for the business to just hire that person as an independent contractor. Another example I can give you is, in my business, we installed and maintained phone systems for customers all over California. Some of our customers included Wells Fargo, California Highway Patrol, the Safeway, Rite Aid. Now, Safeway is in the business, as an example, of selling consumers food at their retail stores. They're not in the business of fixing the phones that, say, spill on aisle 5. However, if they have a phone system in every single retail store, as they do, they need to make sure that those things are operational. So they will make a choice as to whether it's better for them to have someone on staff in-house to maintain that infrastructure for them, or whether it makes sense for them to hire someone outside to maintain that infrastructure for them. In many situations, businesses have found that, in this particular example, it's cheaper for them to hire someone outside, and then it's also not their core business. Their core business is, in this case, Safeway, is selling groceries to consumers. So they're not in the phone system business or the telecom business.
Right, right. Well, so then I think it becomes clearer for someone who is listening and thinking, well, you know, I've been in a particular area of business. I have some expertise in it. I've been let go. I'm not finding work again in my profession. But what they can do is start to think creatively about going into business for themselves.
Absolutely.
Well, so then the question arises, how does a person strategize going into business? And I know that there are at least, you know, two major ways that one can do this. You can start your own company,
mm-hmm.
or you can buy an existing company.
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit about both of those things.
Okay. So what I would say is, before you even get to that point, number one, I think it's important for you to know what your passion is in life. I know that many entrepreneurs are very passionate about specific services that they provide. They might be passionate about doing something for the environment or the global healthcare situation, et cetera. So if you have a specific passion in life, it's important to look in the mirror and honestly recognize that, because whatever endeavor you take on from an entrepreneurial perspective, you're going to be living, eating, breathing, sleeping that entrepreneurial venture 24/7.
I can attest to that 100%.
As you know.
I went into entrepreneurship 100% full-time back in November.
Yep.
And I don't believe I have worked this many hours a day since I was in college.
That's right. I worked, when I was running my telecom company in California, people would say, well, you're your own boss. And I had 25 employees and 55 sales affiliates. So people would say, well, you're your own boss. You could take off whenever you want. In reality, I didn't take a single 1 week vacation in 7 years.
Sure.
So number one is make sure that this business fits in line with your passion and with your goals for yourself personally. Number two, and equally important, is whatever business you go into needs to provide a service or a product that customers, whether they be business or consumer, customers want and are willing to pay for. So if they're not willing to pay for it, then that just means that you're not providing a product or a service that's sellable.
Yeah.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, when you're a business owner or an entrepreneur, your number one focus is sales.
Right.
You're looking for new customers and you're looking to keep your current customers happy.
Right.
So the more you look at your business opportunity from a sales perspective, i.e., can I sell this product? Who would I sell it to? Where are they willing to pay for it? Which is very important. If you can't get a yes answer to those questions, then you need to re-strategize your business and say, well, maybe there's some other type of business that I need to be looking at.
Because if people are not paying for it, it's a hobby.
That's correct. It's not a business. It's a hobby.
It's a hobby. Okay, so then, as you've said, it's really important to make sure it's something that you're passionate about, that you can do for long periods of time and remain interested in. And then it's also important to make sure that it's something that is actually marketable.
That's correct.
That people will actually pay for it. Would you then want to get into the difference between starting your own business and buying a business?
So there's two different things. I bought a business. I have other friends who have started businesses. The buy versus start question is really going to come down to what are you looking to get out of a purchase if you purchased a business? So, for example, let me give you some specifics on my business. I bought a business in the telecom sector because I knew that, A, I have a background in telecommunications. B, I knew that businesses needed their telecom infrastructure. America is a country that cannot live without its phones. And so if your phones are broken, you need to get them fixed. And then number three, or C, the price for buying a business in the small business level is fairly inexpensive. So you can buy a business for about 3 to 4 times cash flow. So what that means is if a company has, let's just hypothetically say, $100 in revenue and $25 in profit or cash flow at the end of the year, that business is probably worth, if you were going to sell it in the marketplace, between $75 and $100.
Okay.
So if you think about, if you put in $100 to get an entity that threw off $25 in cash every year, that's a pretty good percent return on your investment.
Right.
Now, if you amplify it by saying, well, by using leverage, which means I'm not going to put in $100, I'm going to put in $30 and take out a $70 loan.
Okay,
so that's 70%, leverage. That would be leverage. It's like taking a mortgage out to buy your house. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you're now putting in $30 of equity to get a business that throws off $25 of cash every year.
Right.
That's a very good percentage return on your investment. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So if a business is out there to potentially buy and that fits your passion and your criteria for what you believe is going to be a good business, you're not only getting it at a good price if you're buying a small business, but you're also going to get something that's established. It has established credibility with customers. It has cash flow. It has a reputation in the marketplace. So you can take that and build upon it.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the process of choosing a business to buy, because you said in the beginning that you looked at over 100 companies before you chose a company to buy. How long did it take you to do that?
2 years. I spent 2 years looking for a business to buy, and I looked at over 200 companies.
So this isn't something that you just jumped in. I mean, I know people who spend less time figuring out who to marry.
That's true. That's true. And I would say that in many ways, buying a business is like a marriage. But what one thing that I would say is I spent two years and looked at 200 companies primarily because once you buy that business, you bought it, you own it.
Right.
And you have to make it work, as Tim Gunn would say.
Yeah.
You can't return it and get your money back.
Right.
So at the end of the day, you have to be very sure that this is going to be a business that is going to excite you personally and reward you financially and professionally.
Yeah.
That means that it's better to take your time looking for something as opposed to just jumping into something. And the other thing I would say is in the process of looking for businesses to buy, it's very important not to get too emotional about any one particular business, because when you're going through the process of looking at a business, usually the business for sale will be represented by a broker, much like a real estate agent will represent a house for sale. And so in that situation, they're going to pull every emotional lever they can on you to try and push you towards paying a higher price and also paying for it right now as opposed to waiting. And that's their job because they're representing the seller. When you're looking at buying, you need to make sure that you detach yourself emotionally. And that's difficult when you haven't had a job for 2 years and you're looking to get involved in something and you have maybe some equity that you want to invest. It's difficult not to get emotional. But my biggest advice to people that come to me looking for advice on the process of buying a business is don't get emotional, because an emotional decision is one that you may regret once you've completed the transaction.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, we're going to take a break for just a moment. I think this is a good point where we can take a break and then shift into the sort of operational part of the conversation.
Okay.
What happens now if you've decided what business you want to start, or if you have decided what business you want to buy, and you know, you're in the driver's seat, you have a chance to strategize your exit. So we're going to talk about strategizing your exit, and we're going to talk about what venture capital is, what private equity is, and how it is that people use that to actually become very wealthy in terms of being entrepreneurs. And then we'll talk a little bit about what it means to be wealthy and why that's not necessarily what this is all about.
Sure.
But we are into prosperity anyway. So we're going to be back in just a moment. I'm going to play another song from Bonge Ziwe Mabandla, this very talented young artist from South Africa. The song is called Umlilo Uwe Sisatu, and it is from Bonge Ziwe's album called Umlilo. And it is sung in Xhosa, which is the language of Miriam Makeba, and the great Nelson Mandela also comes from a Xhosa-speaking background. So if you'd like more information about the artist, please check my blog tomorrow. Meanwhile, enjoy, and we will be back in just a moment.
Well,
And welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed that. That was Bongeziwe Mabanza. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the social and financial issues that concern you most. I'm your host, Batabile Ntombeni, relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in relationship negotiation and divorce mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I will guide the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Work out your child support and parenting issues without spending years in court. For more information, visit my website, www.123untangled.com. That's www.123untangled.com. I want to take a moment to tell you folks about a very worthy cause I'd like you to take a look at. Foodprints is a program that teaches young people about good nutrition with an emphasis on hands-on learning. The students actually learn to grow and cook their own food. Currently, Foodprints, which is funded by Fresh Farm Markets, a nonprofit organization operating the largest network of producer-only farmers markets in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, is raising money for a proper kitchen to teach the kids to cook in. And they only have 3 days left to raise the money that they need for their kitchen. Right now, their cooking classes are held in a regular classroom. They cook on portable hot plates, have no oven or dishwasher, and they have to wash their fresh garden produce in a tiny science lab sink. I've asked Jennifer Mampara, who is the program's director, to be a guest on the show later this summer when I do a series on nutrition and about the possibilities of growing your own food even in an urban environment. So I'm looking forward to having her as a guest on the show, and I was really excited when I learned about her organization. So for now, check out the link to the fundraiser, which is on my blog. And this is the blog that is related to the show. You can find it at www.untangledresolutions, that's one word, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. And on the right-hand side of the screen, you'll see this beautiful photograph of these wonderful kids carrying a basket of fresh produce. And they have a Kickstarter fundraiser that's going on, only 3 days left to raise the money that they need to build their kitchen. So please go to the website, www.untangledresolutions.blogspot.com, and donate as you can to this very wonderful cause. Okay, Pankaj, we're back. I have with me Pankaj Amin, who is the managing director of SC Ventures, which is a company that invests in and consults with small businesses. And before the break, we were talking about how a person can choose or decide what business to go into. And they are themselves choosing to invest in an entrepreneurial venture. So now I want to talk a bit about the big money, the venture firms, and how they decide who to invest in when they are looking to buy businesses. And you know, we'll talk a little bit about how it is that they make these decisions, but we also want to help entrepreneurs know what they need to do as they are growing their businesses to make sure that their businesses are attractive to outside investors.
Sure.
So what kinds of things should people be thinking about as they establish their businesses and manage them?
Sure, and that's a really good question. It's really going to be dependent upon the type of firm that you're looking to market your business to. So there are, broadly speaking, there are venture capital firms and there are private equity firms. And even though we often lump them into the same bucket, they actually have somewhat different strategies for what they invest in and how they invest. So let me just cover each one, 2 seconds of background on each one of them. A venture capital firm uses what I would call a home run strategy. What that means is they will typically invest in startups that at one point they will hope will grow into the next eBay or Google or Facebook. Typically what they will do is they will invest a little bit of equity into a number of startups, and they will take positions in specific sectors of the startup universe. And then they'll say that, you know, if 1 out of 10 of my investments makes it, that's going to make the overall return for my fund. Okay? A private equity firm, on the other hand, uses what I would call a base hit strategy as opposed to a home run strategy. They will invest in large established businesses that have positive cash flow, typically. Okay? What that means is a private equity firm, and one of the most famous private equity firms is KKR, which bought Safeway, or they bought RJR Nabisco. That's probably their most famous deal from Barbarians at the Gate, which is the famous book.
Right.
RJR Nabisco was a company that was highly profitable, threw off very predictable cash flow year over year. And consequently, the private equity firm invests equity into that business to buy it, but then they also are able to take that business and go and get bank financing to get a loan against the cash flows of the business.
Okay.
So it's a base hit strategy in that they don't put money into 10 different things hoping that one of them is successful and then the other 9 just fall off the table. They're investing in businesses where every business needs to be a successful investment for them, and they're amplifying their return by using bank leverage because they can in that situation and venture capitalists can't. So those are two, and in some ways your structure of do I buy a business or do I start a business actually lends itself well towards the structure of, well, do I talk to venture capitalists or do I talk to private equity firms?
So a private equity firm is more like starting up a business.
It's the other way around.
Okay.
So if I started a business and then I wanted to get additional funding to really grow that business, I might go to a venture capital firm.
I see.
Okay.
Okay.
If I buy a business and then maybe grow it to a size range that a private equity firm might be interested in looking at it, then a private equity firm would buy a more established business.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And out of curiosity, where do they get their money? The venture capital firm, the private equity firm, where do they get their money?
Good question. They get their money from institutional investors. So, for example, in some ways, they're getting their money from everybody, you know, the overall American people, because the California CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, is the largest retirement system in the country. They invest, they will take a small slice of their overall funds and invest them in private equity firms, venture capital firms, and other alternative investments.
So in a way, we are all private equity investors. I mean, those people who are...
Indirectly,
yes. Right. So those of us who are employed or are paying into a 401k fund, right? So what happens with the money in that fund, the reason why your money grows in your retirement fund is because the fund will hire managers who will then decide where to invest the money?
Yeah, and not necessarily just to be to be clear, not necessarily a 401k fund,
okay.
but a public retirement fund.
Okay.
Okay. So a 401k fund has certain restrictions as to where you can invest that money,
mm-hmm.
but a public retirement fund that has an endowment manager or an endowment of the University of Texas, which has one of the largest endowments in the country,
mm-hmm.
Princeton University,
mm-hmm.
your alma mater,
mm-hmm.
Harvard University, those folks have chief investment officers that will make decisions on how to manage and oversee the money that they have that they're entrusted to.
Okay.
And some of that money, a small slice of that, will go to private equity firms and venture capital firms. So a venture capital firm will go out and raise a fund, which will typically be a 7-year fund or an 8-year fund that they will raise.
Time limit.
Yeah, so they will raise a fund maybe today, and the assumption is that in 7 years they're going to close that particular fund, and they'll have other funds that they're running concurrently, but then after X number of years they're going to be giving their money plus
the interest,
any profits,
or profits. Right, right,
back
profits.
To the initial investors, the
okay.
institutional investors.
Okay. Now, when it comes to buying an established business, because this is what we're talking about really, I mean, with venture capital, let me make sure I'm not switching up my terminology here, but with venture capital, you are working with startups, right? And so we're not talking about the situation that we described, the hypothetical that we described at the beginning of the show, which is a person who perhaps has been let go from their job and has
and buys a business.
And well, decides to buy a business or to start a business, but we're not talking about at the beginning. We're talking about a person who has been running a company for a while and now is looking to get out. So that's where private equity
might be applicable for them.
Right.
Now, one of your questions earlier, which I definitely want to address, is what are these firms potentially looking for in a business when they look to make these investments?
Exactly.
So there are several things that they're looking for. And most importantly, if you own an established, low-tech, profitable business, so not a startup that's going to be a home run, but an established business that is a great business, private equity firms are going to look for the profitability of the business. First and foremost, they want to see predictable ongoing cash flow and cash flow growth. So if you can show 10-15% growth year over year over the last 5 years, that's a nice story for them, because they're going to take that information to the bank and say, well, we want you to lend money against this business so that we can make this purchase. So they need to be able to convince a bank to give them a loan on that business. If you have erratic cash flows, a bank's not going to want to give you a loan to buy that business.
Yeah.
Number two, you really need to have a business where you can take yourself out of the business and the business still operates and hums along. That's probably the most important and the most difficult hurdle for many small business owners to overcome, because they're intrinsically tied into the overall operations of the business. If you're running a business, even if it's a fairly large business, If you ask yourself, if I just got hit by a bus tomorrow, is the business still going to keep on running? And the reason that's important is because if you sell your business to a private equity firm, you're not going to be there anymore. And so they really are looking for businesses that they can take that overall manager out or that owner out and have a business that's still viable. Otherwise, what are they paying their money for? So that's a second critical element, and if you don't have a business that meets that criteria, you really need to think through, what can I do organizationally so that I can potentially take myself out of the business? Because that's going to be what helps you make a much better pitch to a potential private equity investor.
Now, aren't there situations, or could there be a situation where you are in business and you decide that owning the business, working in the business is still good for you, but owning the business, maybe you feel it would be great to be able to take a break from that or relax from that. Are there situations where business owners sell the business but stay in the business and now become an employee, let's say?
Well, yeah, there are situations like that. And number one, I think that you have to have a real interesting story for why you no longer want to own the business. Because the buyer is usually thinking, what does this person know about this business and this industry that I don't know, which is causing them to sell?
Okay.
So it
might raise a red flag.
It does raise a red flag, absolutely, because at the end of the day, I'm never going to know as much about your business and your industry as you do, being an insider with several years of experience running and operating that business. So if I come in as an outside investor, I really have to look at everything with a slight grain of salt. So getting back to your scenario, if you are someone who wants to maybe still work at the business but then maybe sell the business and continue working, you may want to consider potentially selling not 100% but maybe 30%, 40%, 50% of the business. So you're taking some of your ownership equity off the table, maybe because you need it to retire or you need it for other reasons, but you still have some skin in the game.
Right, exactly. So I can see how a person who's looking to buy a business might feel better about you being willing to stay in. It shows at least that you're committed to the business. You have faith in the business as an ongoing concern, rather than it seeming as though you might be hiding something and be trying to skip
down.
Yeah,
you're not trying to just jump off the ship. You actually still have a piece of that ship that's in your name.
Exactly.
Okay. That's another thing. Now, a third thing that I wanted to mention about attractiveness of your business is the growth potential.
Mm-hmm.
So many times private equity firms will look for businesses that they feel they can grow either through follow-on acquisition.
What does that mean?
What that means is, let's say I buy a business, a fabulous business in New York. Are there other businesses in Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, Dallas that I can also buy, so that I put together a much larger entity that is equally valuable, but now 10 times as valuable because I bought 10 of them? That's one potential growth strategy.
Well, in a situation that I actually have some experience with is with medical offices, actually. So I know that there are investors who may buy a number of medical offices and then manage them with an umbrella corporation, whereas you used to have independent doctors. Now you have this large group that can take advantage of
economies of scale.
Exactly.
So in many ways you can say, well, and the story, the high level story is that, we'll put 10 of these together, whether it's doctor's offices or anything else. We'll put 10 of these together, rip out some administrative costs, rip out some general costs, and then hopefully have a more profitable, larger, and more valuable business at the end. Now, that being said, actually executing on some of those strategies it's not a walk in the park.
Mm-hmm.
There are significant operational challenges in bringing a bunch of businesses together, but if you can at least show a story towards that potential opportunity, that's going to be something that will be attractive to a private equity investor.
Okay. So let's get a little bit specific here. One of the things you do is to go into companies that may be not living up to their potential and help them to sort of revamp the way that they do things so that they can increase the profitability for the benefit of the person who's coming in to buy. Am I describing what you do, or part of what you do at least, accurately?
Absolutely. So I've operated as an investor. So I bought a telecom company in California. I've also invested in other businesses and other ventures. In addition to that, I've also gone into businesses that may not be looking to be bought, but said, okay, your five-year plan is to be bought maybe 5 years from now, and let's come up with the real cost reduction or operational advantages that we can come up with so that you're really getting the highest cash flow possible, so that when you sell, you're getting the best possible price for yourself.
But when you've gone in, have you found typical mistakes that entrepreneurs make or business managers make that might slow down the growth of their businesses?
Not necessarily slow down, but I have seen there are numerous examples of businesses that don't pay attention to the details. So I was actually talking to a restaurateur who said, if I can save 5 cents on a napkin, that's a big deal for me, because every 5 cents that we save on a napkin in our restaurant allows us to become more profitable. When you look at your business, you need to have that level of granularity in how you assess costs in your business. You need to get down to the detail of, where can I save 5 cents here or 5 cents there? There are lots of places in most businesses where opportunities to cut costs are available without sacrificing quality of service to the customer, responsiveness to the customer, the intangible benefits of having good morale in your with your employees and your staff. And so there are opportunities to cut costs as long as you're willing to get down into those details.
But here's one that I remember. I hope that I'm recalling it correctly, but there was an airline I heard about that saved hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on gasoline by not painting the planes.
Uh-huh.
Right? They didn't fully paint the planes. They put sort of the logo on the plane, but left the plane silver.
Yep.
Because it overall reduced the weight of all of the planes, and when you aggregated all of that, they were able to save a ton of money.
Yep.
By just not painting the planes. And there is something that didn't impact the customers at all, didn't impact morale for the employees, but it still saved the company a lot of money.
That's correct. And some sources of finding those cost reduction opportunities are actually your employees and your customers. Southwest Airlines is a good example of a company that this is not in a recent downturn, in one maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the CEO, his name was Herb Keller at the time, he went to his employees and said, help us figure out ideas whereby we can reduce our costs. And the employees' feedback and ideas that he got from his overall employee network within Southwest Airlines was able to significantly reduce those costs, because those people are the ones who know where there are inefficiencies in the system, because
right.
they're living those inefficiencies
right.
every day.
Right.
Not only do you get to cut costs, but you also get the potential of making your employees' lives happier, because
right.
they're not dealing with an inefficient infrastructure.
Exactly. So making sure that you listen to the eyes and ears on the ground.
That's right.
Is really important for a person who is a business owner looking to keep their company attractive, lean and mean, and so forth, but attractive to outside investors when they're getting ready to sell.
That's right.
We're going to be coming down toward the end of the show, actually. I can't believe it's gone so fast.
Time flies when you're having fun, right?
It certainly does, and I've been having so much fun talking to you. I want to make sure that I don't miss an opportunity to ask you to come back.
Absolutely.
Because I'm sure that there are a lot of details that we haven't gone through. There's a lot of opportunity for us to get into some of the more specifics. And speaking of questions, I want to pop over to the chat room and see about what kinds of questions that we have from the chat room. Internet business. Somebody asked a question about, can an internet business grow enough to be sold? What do you think
Absolutely. About internet business? And there's so many examples of internet businesses that have grown enough to be sold. If they're making profits, if they are, and in some cases, I mean, 10, 12 years ago, even internet businesses that were not making profits were highly attractive to the investor community. Yeah. That was a situation that was potentially a temporary situation, but at the end of the day, some startup businesses that are not even making money will be attractive because people are very convinced of the growth strategy. But absolutely, internet businesses can grow enough to be sold.
Well, you know, you mentioned something, if we can do this very quickly, there may be pitfalls when it comes to private equity and when it comes to venture capital especially. And perhaps I'll have you come back and talk a little bit more specifically about those things. You mentioned the book Barbarians at the Gate. There was a time in the 80s where venture capital got a really bad rap. With some of the behavior of some of the barons of business. And so is there something that you can very quickly tell people to look out for so that they're not taken advantage of if they're going to be negotiating the sale of their business?
You know, it's a really good point. And, you know, these firms are looking to make a profit. And so one of the ways in which they make a profit is by negotiating a good deal with the companies that they buy, and then adding value in whatever way they do, and then selling those businesses at a higher level. So when you're selling, your goal is to get the highest price possible. And so some of the ways in which you can do that is you know, there are certain books that I would recommend buying on the strategy and the tactics of selling your business. One of them is called Selling Your Business by Holmes Crouch. Another one is called Buyout by Rick Rickertsen. These books will kind of take you through what to expect in the process, and then also what to expect from a price point perspective. And if you want to get further information, I would recommend talking to a middle market business advisor or a broker, and there are associations such as the Association for Corporate Growth that are involved with those types of professionals, and they're there for you to show you what is the going rate for businesses at this particular period in time.
Right.
So those are things you can do to kind of make sure you're not getting a bad deal.
And for those of you who are listening, I will be sure to have that information up on the blog that is related to this show. It is at www.untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. A lot of dots involved there, but untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. We will make sure to have this information up for you. Pankaj, it's been wonderful having you here, and in terms of whatever's left over, people can call in for a future show when you come in to visit again. I do want to also say, you know, the song that I played in the opening, it's called Bunuza and Bogezi Mabanza, and it's about a man who is very, very rich, and a terrible thing happened to him, and so the song is sort of lamenting his misfortune. And I wanted to end by sort of addressing the fact that we're talking about making money. We're talking about people who've become fabulously wealthy. But I don't want to leave the impression that this is all that it's about.
That's correct. At the end of the day, our happiness, our personal happiness, is tied to things like money, but it's also tied to a number of other things. And people make money, people lose money throughout their lives and their careers, but having a good sense of grounding on who you are and your own personal happiness is really the most important thing. There's another song where one of the lines is, it's not about having what you want, it's about wanting
what
you
have. Absolutely.
And that really is a way in which I think most of us should try and look at life, because in business, things can go up, but they can also go down.
Right. Well, thank you again so very much, and thank you all for listening. I'm going to leave you with another song from Bongezi Wema Mabanza. This one is called Bendit Siti, and it's also from Bongeziwe's album Umlilo. For more about this artist, check my blog tomorrow on tangledresolutions.blogspot.com. Have a wonderful week, everyone. Next week is Father's Day. So look out for updates on the blog about what the show will feature. Have a wonderful week, as I said, and goodbye for now.